Arteta is leveling the playing field.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you what exactly you mean by that.
Yeah. Well, I really mean it quite literally, because at this point, most of the laws, most of the rules that we implement laws with are increasingly against ordinary people, against working folks, against young people, against immigrants. There's just such an unlevel playing field. I'll give you two or three examples real quick. You know, we've gone from a period a couple of generations ago where we had a third of the workforce in labor unions to now where we have well under 10%, really closer to 6% in private sector. More than 50% of Americans would prefer to work for a union company and work union job, but like 6% do. So how did that happen? Well, it happened because we changed the laws progressively over the last 40 years to the point where it is simply much, much harder to talk about a union on the floor of a business or a shop. Employers can make it completely illegal for people to have conversations about a union except during their break time. They can prohibit, and they do, posting literature about the union. At the same time, the company is free to put all kinds of anti-union stuff all over the shop, even to call the employees in to talk to their supervisors in an intimidating setting, kind of say, are you going to vote for the union or not? So that's an example of how we've used laws to basically benefit the biggest companies and the wealthiest people at the expense of, in this case, workers. A similar thing. You no doubt are very familiar with all of the sexual harassment scandals, Harvey Weinstein and all of these big celebrities that have been either convicted or accused. A good bit of that went on for many years because of something in labor law that's allowed now very commonly, that's called a non-disclosure agreement. So now, used to be these non-disclosure agreements were very rare. Now it's utterly commonplace that when you get a job, you have to sign the fine print, and it includes these non-disclosure agreements. That allowed people like Bill O'Reilly and others to be harassing and in some cases abusing women, but they couldn't disclose it. They were legally bound not to say anything. Instead, they'd get a payout. That's another example of a totally unlevel playing field between an employer and an employee. A third example is this recently passed tax bill. Absolute, you know, little crumbs for working people and middle class people, but the wealthiest and the biggest companies are the ones that got the preponderance of that tax break. Some say between 70 and 80% of all the benefit went to those at the very top. So here again, you have the rich and the powerful being made richer and more powerful. And what are some of the things that are going to bite the dust as a result of that big tax break? Well, funding for programs in Southwest Virginia, like rural development, like the Appalachian Regional Commission, like student loan debt relief is on the chopping block. We don't have nearly enough student loan debt options right now as it is, relief options, and yet because of those tax breaks, we may well have even fewer. So I could go on and on, but there are so many different ways. And to me, I think the role of the government is not to give people stuff. I think it's to enable people to help themselves. That's what I think the government's role is. Of course, it's security, protecting us from danger. But fundamentally, it's to invest in people and communities so we can care for ourselves. And what they're doing is exactly the opposite. They're taking investment away from communities. They're giving breaks to those who already have so much. And this playing field keeps getting more and more skewed instead of coming like this.
That is that's interesting. And I'm sure there are a lot of people who agree with you on that one, and people have noticed stuff like this.
Yeah.
All right. So a lot of things you said, but and also a lot of things that you have on your website that I checked. They seem to be very middle of the road, one way, another way, very moderate, I suppose, in that way. And I also couldn't find anything. Do you have any sort of political party affiliations? Are you one?
I'm a Democrat, yeah.
You're a Democrat?
Yeah.
All right. I just wanted to clear that up because I actually wasn't too sure.
Okay.
How do you feel about running as a Democrat here in a more predominantly Republican area?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because until about a decade ago, there was a lot of elected Democrats in the 9th District of Virginia. Rick Boucher was the congressman for many, many years. Phil Puckett Joe Johnson. They were in at state level office. So we had representatives at both the state and federal level. We still have quite a few Democratic sheriffs and Democratic constitutional officers. So it is a more Republican area, no doubt about it. Here's why. I mean, I'm running as a Democrat because it's the party that is closer to my values and beliefs. I would be very candid and say that I don't think either party has done very well addressing the needs of working people in rural communities. I think rural communities have been neglected, places like the Ninth, and working folks generally. I think the Republicans are much worse. I don't think the Democrats are nearly good enough. And I'm running as a very strong, kind of old-fashioned populist Democrat, a progressive Democrat who believes that, again, the purpose of government is to invest in people and help people help themselves, help people build strong economies and communities from the bottom up is the way I talk about it. So I am a Democrat. I'm proud to be a Democrat, but I also am somebody who absolutely recognizes and owns up to the fact that the Democratic Party has not been a strong enough, clear enough voice for working people and for rural communities.
Great. All right, so you're here because of the protests. You're in the area, and you just recently attended one of those walkouts, didn't you?
Well, it got snowed out.
Really?
Yes.
It did.
Well, it got snowed out.
There was, however, one here on this campus.
On Radford's campus.
Yes, there
was. That's good.
And,
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, since you intended to attend one at least,
yes.
What about the protest really got your attention and made you want to be around for it?
Well, the first I heard of the protests, I mean, I'd probably seen something in the news, but was at a town hall meeting in Floyd, Virginia, almost 3 weeks ago. And it was, we had a town hall meeting that my campaign sponsored, had about 100 people come out. Afterwards, right immediately after, there was a little informal gathering around what to do about gun violence. And it was led by high school students from Floyd, but primarily from Reiner, Virginia, a little community. It was Auburn High School in Reiner, Virginia. Some incredibly sharp and thoughtful young people that were basically talking about the fact that they just weren't going to sit around anymore and let this happen, as young people are doing around the country. And so they were organizing at that point. They were in the early stages of planning and organizing the walkout. I had intended, so that's where I learned about it from them, and I had intended to go either to the Auburn High School or to Blacksburg or to Washington County, my home county. All three of them got snowed out. But nevertheless, I was proud to be part of that if I could have been, because again, I really reward young people rising up. I think millennials from high school age on up to their early 30s, it's time for that group to really take ownership and take leadership in the country. The reason we're holding this youth summit in a few days is really because we recognize that the millennial group demographic has not been well served by many of our public policies, and it's time for them to make that known and change things. So I was really proud of that, and also I think that, in terms of this, not only these mass shootings, but gun violence in general, we've had a policy now for about 20 years that's basically to do nothing. Shooting happens, shooting, and then a lot of hand-wringing, a lot of public debate, something has to be done, and what always happens? Nothing. So I'm a believer in Second Amendment rights. I own a gun, I have a farm, I own a gun. I would never have any interest in trying to take away law-abiding citizens' guns. However, there is clearly a need for a much stronger background check system. There is a need to begin to deal with some of the mental health and anger issues that are often associated with this in schools, on college campuses, and in the community at large. And there's also a need to begin to deal with the excess firepower, the bump stocks, the magazines with many, many rounds of ammunition. And all of that should be on the table. We should be making serious progress on that. And that's what the young folks are talking about, and that's why I wanted to be part of it.
All right. So this town hall you're doing later today here on campus, what is it all about? And I've seen that you've done similar events in the past.
Yes. We're actually planning to do, we've committed to doing 100 town halls before the November election. Oof. Tonight's will be, I think, the 28th. So the town halls, the basic purpose of them is for me to learn, because the first thing that happens after a short introduction is we just open the floor to whoever's there. What are your concerns? What are your priorities? What are your ideas for fixing things, for making things better? That's always the format. And then for 10, 15, 20 minutes, however long people want to talk, people speak out to those things. We write down what they say, and then I do my best to respond. Sometimes they ask me very specific questions, like, what is your position on this? Other times they just express a general concern about this. So that's the way these town halls have been working. I've been doing them all around the 9th District. And again, it's an opportunity, first, for me to learn, second, for other people to learn who I am and what I stand for, which is, of course, critical to know who they should vote for. And then we take all that information back, and we're actually keeping a running tally of what came up through every town hall, so that by the time we get to the 60th or 70th town hall, we'll know which issues were the most common across the district. Some of the town halls, many of them, are just town halls. They're just general, whoever wants to come out. Others are focused more on specific groups. So we've done town halls at Virginia Tech and at UVA Wise, at Emory and Henry in Virginia Highlands, and then Radford's tonight would be the fifth in the series of town halls focused on college students, young people. We've also done town halls with teachers, where we have our Saturday big Millennial Youth Summit, which will be a giant town hall. We're doing town halls on Black Lung, on building the next economy with, you know, a more sustainable economy. We're doing town halls on food, farming, and agriculture. So some of our town halls are kind of topical or for specific groups, and others are wide open.
Out of this 100 town hall tally, which one is this one? I'm curious.
This one, I think, is the 28th. So we're a little more than a fourth the way there.
Yeah,
we got quite a ways to go, but we also have another at least dozen already on the books. So we have, you know, we're getting close to half in terms of planned town halls. We still have quite a few to happen.
All right. Okay. Well, this is a question about the issues. I'm curious which issue you would say you are most passionate about personally.
You know, there's a lot of them, and the website doesn't deal with all of them, but it does cover a lot of them. For me, the single most important issue, with a lot of close seconds and thirds,
I'm sure,
is building a healthy economy that works for people.
Headlined on that one.
I mean, that's the work I've done the last 30 years. Yes. I wrote a book about it.
I saw.
And I write blog posts about it, and I talk about it all the time. I mean, it's number one, everybody needs a good job, or people, you know, put another way, people need to be able to take care of themselves and their families. And too often, either people can't find work, or more common, they're underemployed, like they got a part-time job here, a part-time job there, and it sort of all doesn't quite add up to a decent living. Or they're in a job that used to pay a good wage 25 years ago, but the wages have barely moved in 25 years, so what used to be a good job now is not so good a job. So for a lot of different reasons, we need to revitalize our economy in the 9th District and around the country. The experiences that I have, I don't have all the answers by any means, but I've worked in that. I've worked with farmers, with loggers, with miners, with downtown redevelopment people, with artisans and craft and musicians. I've worked with that full array and have a pretty good sense of some of the things that work. Like, if we are in a community and it seems like it's the economy's stagnant, what can we do? So I think building the economy so that young people have opportunities for good jobs. And here's the other piece about it. When you build these bottom-up economies that I talk about, it is about jobs, but it's about more than that, because then you can also begin to think about, well, what are the things people want in their community? We have a town in west of Abingdon called St. Paul. It's a town of fewer than 1,000 people. I lived there when I first moved to the 9th District back in the 80s. That's where I lived for quite a while. St. Paul is a town of about 970 people. It's a coal town. It used to be very much a coal industry town. And for the last decade and a half, they've been reinventing themselves. This little, tiny coal town with a lot of poverty. So that today, if you go to St. Paul, you'll find a terrific craft brewery, local brewery that was started there. You'll find a trail right along the Clinch River in town and other trails circling the town. So, and you'll find an outfitter business that will put you in a canoe or a kayak to go on the Clinch River. There is a boutique hotel that was just opened up a month ago that is built into some old buildings that were slated to be torn down, and instead they restored them and created this remarkably unique hotel with inside a farm-to-table restaurant that's buying from local farmers, and the chef is from the county. On top of that, they've got several other emerging businesses. So you look at that and you think, well, not only is there a growing set of job opportunities in St. Paul, but this is kind of a cool place to be.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, it's not just a sleepy old town. It's actually got stuff to do and more things coming all the time, music, art scene, outdoor recreation. So I guess my point is, when I say that economic revitalization, building healthy economies from the bottom up, is my number one priority, that's because I think when you build a real diverse, interesting economy, you also get nicer places to live. And when you get nicer places to live, young people tend to want to stay or migrate there rather than go into the big city, if our towns can be vibrant. And when young people come or stay, then you have all the innovation, all the energy, all the new thinking that goes with your generation that my generation doesn't always have. So that's really, for me, the kind of foundation. Now, of course, on top of that, we've got to deal with universal health care. We've got to deal with student loan debt. There's many, many other issues, but that economic one's the foundation.
I noticed that universal health care one is probably, I suppose, the more radical of one of your opinions. I mean, it's some would say, I suppose.
Yeah,
Can you tell me about how you arrived at the conclusion that universal health care is the way to go?
Yes, and I did, because I looked at other options as well for quite some time, but I've been a supporter of Medicare for All now for a little while for a couple of reasons. Number one, it is less and less considered a radical idea. I've been in groups of farmers, and we're talking about prices on their farm products, and we're talking about soil, and we're talking about regulations. Invariably, healthcare comes up, and the farmers talk about the fact that as self-employed people, they just can't afford this healthcare anymore. And so they are becoming, a farmer is a pretty conservative lot, they're becoming open to universal healthcare options like Medicare for All. Here's the second thing. My brother and my brother-in-law, my wife's brother-in-law, are doctors. And neither one of them, especially my brother-in-law, are big fans of the government. You know, they're not like bleeding heart liberals. But both of them will tell you that while dealing with Medicare and Medicaid can be challenging, it's nothing like dealing with the private insurance companies. The private insurance companies change the rules more often. They're way harder to deal with. They don't respond to you. I mean, so these are doctors, kind of hard-nosed guys, that completely believe in a Medicare for All universal system. So they see it from the inside, and they say, this is our best chance of getting truly universal coverage, because Obamacare did cover, you know, 20 million more people, but there's still plenty of uninsured, and reining in costs, because we know that Medicare, that's not perfect. The overhead in Medicare is around 4 or 5%. The overhead with private insurance is around 20%. So it's the way to go. My position is I'm a firm supporter and will fight for Medicare for All. And at the same time, while we're working on that, we need to be stabilizing our hospitals in rural areas, because we've lost some hospitals that have closed.
Really?
Yeah, in Lee County and Patrick County. And we need to be investing in community clinics. Community clinics deliver great care at a very low cost. And we have several of them in the Ninth. We need to be shoring them up and perhaps opening some others.
You never think about a hospital closing.
I know,
always
it's pretty amazing.
Take them as a given.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Lee County lost its hospital about 4 years ago, and Lee County's already way out there, and so folks were having to drive 50, 60 miles to get to a hospital. So just think, if you have an emergency.
If you're in an emergency situation, yeah. you're not
in good shape.
Yeah, so definitely, yes. All right. I have experienced firsthand what you're talking about with the towns having to reinvent themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not from the 9th District. But my hometown of Danville has been hit very hard by the leaving of industry.
Right.
Used to have, you know, the mill and all
right.
of that. And while Goodyear is still there, there's not much else. And so I've seen that those old downtown buildings be reinvented for other uses.
Yeah.
And small, the farm-to-table restaurants coming into existence. So,
absolutely. And we need that stuff. And we need, you know, good-paying manufacturing jobs. And there are people, there's a guy right here in Radford, just outside of the university, who has a business called Acme Panel. And Joe Fortier is his name. He converted an old abandoned tire factory, I believe it was, to this manufacturer that makes these super insulated building panels. They're called SIPS, Structurally Insulated Panel Systems, SIPS panels. But they're basically the size of a sheet of plywood, 4x8. They can also be 4x12 for bigger buildings. Mm-hmm. And they're in between. They have a tremendous amount of insulation. And then when you put them up to create your building, it could be a college building, it could be a home, they lock together. So these panels cut the energy use by 50% compared to a well-insulated home, 50%. And they're much stronger in a storm, much stronger. They'll withstand winds that a regular house can't.
Really?
So now think about that. Think about this climate change-influenced world we're in. What do we have? Like growing need to reduce our energy use because of emissions and energy costs. And we have a lot more storm activity. So here's a guy right down the road making a perfect product for that. It's a small business, but he's employing several people. On top of it all, most of the electricity to run his machines come from solar panels he put on the roof. So that's the kind of business that we should be looking to start all around the night. Businesses like that that address our real problems and at the same time create good jobs.
So you grew up as a farmer.
I did. I grew up as a gardener, but I've been farming now for 24 years.
I wanted to know what sort of experience you've gained from that type of work.
Yeah.
The lessons you've learned.
Yeah, so farming makes you humble because, you know, I studied agriculture in school many years ago at the University of Kentucky, agriculture and ecology, and that helped. But there's just so much you can't control on a farm. You can, if you know what you're doing, it helps in terms of controlling insects and disease and weeds and what crops to grow and which grow better where and what their water needs are. All that is useful, but ultimately there's a lot you can't control in farming, and so it makes you humble. It really makes you appreciate the value of physical work because we're a society that's kind of denigrated really physical work. If you work hard as a construction worker or a plumber or a farmer or a logger, you know, people don't exactly hold that in high esteem. They kind of think, oh, unless you have a job where you're at a desk at a computer, you're sort of must not be very smart. So with farming, you understand that first of all, you got to use your brains a lot because you got to be on your toes, and second, you got to use your brawn or your body a lot. And I really like that. I like that it keeps you humble and it keeps you working hard. And then the third thing is that I've recognized that it's really exciting, the local food movement that has taken hold over the last 20 years. A lot of my work was helping to promote the idea of buying local food, buying organic food, all that stuff. But it's really interesting how when people, such a small part of the population farms anymore, about 1 to 1.5% farm. So a lot of people are so disconnected, their experience of food is Kroger or Safeway or Food City. And then, you know, so a big challenge that farmers face is getting the people that that eat, which is everybody, to recognize that, first of all, farming is challenging, and secondly, that cheap food sometimes comes with a cost. If you buy that cheap pork chop or you buy that cheap biscuit at Hardee's, the breakfast biscuit, very, very likely that the eggs or the pork that was in that biscuit was raised in a big industrial CAFO operation, a confined animal feedlot operation, and there's a lot of negative consequences to those, environmentally, water pollution, health of the workers, not to mention the treatment of the animals. So farming really, it humbles you, but it also kind of inspires you to try to make connections with consumers, with people who might buy your product.
So, you're focusing a lot on young people. Mm-hmm. You've got the young people town hall meeting mm-hmm. Tonight.
Right.
So, what precisely would your plans be to help college students should you be elected?
Great. So, first off, again, having more economic opportunities, better job opportunities, is a really important thing. One of the challenges college students have been facing the last few years is they come out of school with a ton of debt and pretty crappy job prospects. I want to address both of those. I want the job prospects to be better by creating the kinds of businesses we were talking about and by really supporting entrepreneurship. One of the people speaking at our conference on Saturday at Virginia Tech at our youth summit is Nicole Dyer. Nicole was the farmer's market manager in Abingdon as like a 24-year-old woman. She started selling juices that she made from local products and little breakfast sandwiches that were sourced 100% locally from the farmers at the market. And it was such a hit at the market that a couple years later, she opened a restaurant that's on Main Street in Abingdon now. It's called White Birch Juice and Cafe. And Nicole's going to be at the summit to share her experience of the challenges and opportunities to be a businesswoman, to be a young entrepreneur. So that's not for everybody, but I will definitely support people who want to go into entrepreneurship to start their own businesses, because young people like Nicole not only create businesses and jobs, she's employing a lot of people, but really innovative jobs. Like everything that she buys in there, virtually everything comes from sustainable local sources. So part of it is the economic, you know, better economic prospects. On the student debt side, there's at least two things we could do very quickly. We lament this student debt problem, and we just keep letting the debt get bigger and bigger. It's now $1.2 or $1.3 trillion total debt. It's insane. Here's two pieces of legislation I would work vigorously for. The first one has already been proposed. It's not been passed. It's called the PAYE Act, P-A-Y-E, and it stands for Pay As You Earn. And the basic idea is that somebody coming out of college with, let's say they have $30,000 debt, whatever it is, they get a job, their loan repayment is tied to how much they earn. And the basic formula in the act is that the first chunk of money you earn to meet sort of basic needs is not counted. So you have a certain allowance kind of up to a little above poverty level that you earn. Above that, you only pay 10% of your income. So if you get out of college and you got an engineering job and you're earning 100 grand, well, you're going to be expected to pay your loan back pretty quickly.
Yes.
But if you get out and you're struggling to find a job and you're waiting tables or maybe you're getting part-time work here and there and your income is only $20,000, $25,000 a year, you're going to be paying very, very little on that student debt. And you'll only pay more as your income increases. I think, and then at some point of payments, whatever is left of your debt gets erased. I think this is a really smart solution, because it just is fair to the students. They're not being taken off the hook totally. You know, they still have to pay. But again, it's proportional to how much you earn. That's just a very sensible approach.
And it gives them that grace period, I suppose.
Breathing room. Absolutely.
Yes. They don't have to worry about immediately needing to go somewhere.
Yes. And the other legislation that could be that but isn't is already on the books. And we have a couple of different things on the books that are known as public service loan forgiveness. And the idea is if you get out of college and you take a job in public service, so that could be with a nonprofit, that could be in an underserved rural area or a poor urban setting, it could be as a teacher in one of those, whatever, it's a public service job. Mm-hmm. If you take that job, then you get to write off some of your student loan debt, gets forgiven as a result of doing that good work. Here's the problem. So that's already on the books. That's out there. Mm-hmm. The problem with that law is that you have to make 120 loan payments before you can even apply for this loan forgiveness. That's 10 years of monthly payments before you can even be eligible to apply for it. So theoretically, that's a good program. But for the most part, people need help when they get out, not 10 years later. 10 years later, they're probably doing okay if they survived, right? So I want to take that public service loan forgiveness program and change the rules on it so that you can start getting that loan relief immediately, maybe just making very, very nominal payments mm-hmm. as you're doing that public service work. So those are two things we can do to tremendously reduce student loan debt.
So the issue that comes to mind when you're talking about any sort of loan forgiveness program is what about the schools? How do they... How would they get their money, essentially?
Well, so the schools didn't loan the money. So that's federal loans and private bank loans. And so what would happen there is that, so the school's not getting full tuition. That's a separate matter that we can talk about. But here you're talking about people who took out loans through the federal government, which there are several of them, or through private lenders. So yes, they might have to write off some of that debt. But again, we're not just saying everybody, it's a holiday, you're free to go about your life, no debts. We're saying people pay as they can, and that's only fair. And ultimately, the banks and the government will probably get back more of their money instead of pushing students to bankruptcy or pushing students to hide from their loan officers because they can't make their payments. I mean, I think these things are practical ways to get the money. Now, in terms of the colleges, we're talking about something else there, which is we need to simply make college more affordable. When you look at the inflation rate of college education, it's dramatically beyond the rest of the economy, right? I mean, when I graduated from the University of Kentucky in 1980, my last semester tuition was $600. So that's a long time ago, but still, even if you adjust for inflation, we're nowhere near that. It's insane. So the ideas for that, to me, is number one, we should have free community college for everybody who needs it. Now, again, there'll be people with plenty of money, they should pay. But if anybody who's a working person, low-income person, up to a lower middle class, should have free community college. For a four-year public school degree like Radford or Tech, there's a couple of different options. I don't necessarily think it should simply be free because I don't know how we would do that.
Yeah.
But what I do think we would do, again, is we would combine federal subsidies and state subsidies such that students pay according to their family's ability. And so if you come out of a family where the parents together earn, $35,000 a year, kind of a just above poverty level in a family of four, if that's the situation, they would be expected to pay, but an amount that the family can afford, and then combined with the student loans that would be, no longer private. We should move away from these private sector loans and have government-backed loans because the private sector loans have higher interest rates. I think that's how we get to affordable college education. That plus we have to really deal with the fact that the cost of a college education has risen much faster than anything else. And it's not because faculty get paid a lot of money. They don't. I know college professors, they don't make that much money. There's a lot of speculation as to why college has gotten so expensive. We do have to grapple with that.
Right. So, I'm trying to think if there's anything else I'd like to know. And I think that about covers it.
Okay.
Yeah.
You do have the flyer and the information about the Millennial Summit?
I do.
Yeah, okay, great.
Maybe you could tell me a bit more about that one.
Okay.
By the time this article runs, it will have already happened.
Oh, it will have already happened? Yes. I wondered about that.
However,
okay.
So I didn't want to make it a focus.
Sure.
However, I am interested in your motivations behind that.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of, so again, my three kids are all Millennials. Mm-hmm. They're 29, 31, and 35. So they're right at that sort of last quarter or third of the millennial thing. And I was dedicated to, I've always had a lot of young people working on my farm. I've had young people working in my consulting business. So I've always had really great connections to young people, but I was sort of struggling with what to do about it. And this young man named Michael Hobbs wrote an article in Huffington Post about 3 months ago. And the title is Generation Screwed. Very provocative title.
Yeah.
It was a very provocative, sometimes confrontational article, but also thoroughly researched, like really, really smartly written. And essentially what the argument he made in great detail, because it was a long, long article, was that so many of the things that helped the baby boomer generation that I'm part of get where we are gone for millennials or dramatically diminished. The cost of education compared to incomes is so much higher. He has a statistic in the article in which he says that the cost of the average cost of a 4-year public university education in 1980 would have required 325 hours of work at a minimum wage job, that whatever a minimum wage job was back then, 325 hours. The cost today of the average public university in terms of minimum wage jobs is 4,200 hours. So that's one of several things in the article where he points out that, sure, people had to work back then. I worked when I went through college, all that stuff. But a little bit of work was all you had to do to earn enough to pay for your education. Now, I mean, 4,000 hours is like working full time for 2 years doing nothing else. And, you know, and you, meanwhile, you're in school. So his article provoked me to think we need to gather young people from all around the ninth to really grapple with these issues. And so we'd already committed to the town halls. We had already started doing the first few town halls. And myself and my staff, and several of my staff are millennials, said, you know, what about the idea of a big summit from high school age all the way up to the end of the millennial generation? So it's sort of like from high school to mid-30s. And the summit's going to start in the morning with a big listening session, kind of a facilitated listening session where everybody can tell me what all their issues and concerns and ideas are. Then we're going to have a small panel of millennial and youth leaders, college and beyond, who will reflect what they've heard. And then I'll share a few thoughts about what I hope to do as a congressman. And then in the afternoon, after lunch, and lunch is included, after lunch, there's four different skill-building workshops, all led by young people. No, I'm the only guy over 35 in the whole crowd that's doing anything. So we have young, we have one on, well, Nicole Dyer. I mentioned the businesswoman who runs the restaurant. She's going to lead a workshop on entrepreneurship. We have a young woman from Kentucky who is a tremendous journalist, and she's going to lead one on using media and social media to change the narrative and to have impact. We've got one on community organizing, one on, and the other is on political organizing. Like, how do you start campaigns? How do you work in a campaign? So it's a combination of a big listening session with a few words from the candidate and then an afternoon of skill building. It should really be dynamic. We're very excited about it.
I personally appreciate your emphasis on the matter of local issues. A lot of people, especially of my age, we have our sights set very high towards Washington.
Right.
And we think that, I mean, of course, that we do have people to send there to represent our specific thoughts, but we often forget or neglect what's going on here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Especially a lot of people of my age, of my generation, they don't pay much attention to congressional elections anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's the presidential ones who get all of the national attention, and
absolutely,
the internet is always focused upon the biggest, newest thing happening.
Right,
and
right. No, I'm glad to hear you say that. It's so true. You know, if I get to Congress, I will definitely be learning about, talking about, fighting these big issues, you know, from climate change to the tax bill, to foreign policy, all of that. But the reality is I'll be one of 435 people. I'll be the new kid on the block for the first few terms. So what that means is where I can have the most impact is right back home, right back in the 9th District, by working with the same people I've worked with the last 30 years and also with the federal agencies that have a presence in the district, from education to agriculture to rural development. So I recognize that even though I'd love to solve those big problems, and I will take a stand on them, that my real impact will be close to home. Yeah.
All right. One last question.
Sure.
You seem like a smart guy. And from your own personal experience going through college, as well as your children doing the same, what sort of advice could you give to current college students like myself? It's something that you think is a problem, something that we tend to make a mistake on. What do you think that you could, what advice do you think you could offer?
So I've taken lately to saying that we've been asking the wrong question when we try to think about how do you create strong economies and opportunities for people. Our question is usually, where are the jobs going to come from? That's what people say. You know, they're in a county or a town with relatively high unemployment, and they say, well, where are the jobs going to come from? I think the question we should be asking is, what is the work that needs to be done? So in Danville, some of the work was finding alternatives for people who used to work in the mill, the furniture factories. I don't know if they went as far as Danville or not, but Southside furniture factories. Finding alternatives for tobacco farmers that were surrounding the community.
I noticed you did that
right,
to help tobacco farmers.
Yeah, the Burley tobacco farmers. We had, I think, a pretty significant. Some of the work is health. How can we be not only a better healthcare system, but how can we be a healthier people? I mean, we're not a very healthy society, you know? So what could we do? So if you start asking the question, if your basic question is, what is the work that needs to be done in this place, this town, this region, whatever, then it opens up possibilities, because then it's like Nicole. She opened that business partly because she wanted to be a business person, but mostly because she wanted to get healthy, really healthy food to her friends and neighbors, and at the same time support local farmers that needed a market for their products. I started a home ownership program for low-income families because it seemed like all the time low-income families were living in trailers or really crappy homes, spending a lot of money on utilities for a terrible house. And so we created a program where we built really modest but solid, well-insulated homes that were very affordable for them to live in, and figured out how to do it in such a way that they would actually pay the mortgage and own the home. It's just one of countless examples. If young people come out of college thinking, where am I going to get a job? That's fair enough. But if you come out thinking, well, what's the work that needs to be done here in Blacksburg, Radford, or maybe back home where I came from, whatever it is, and start looking for opportunities to create your own thing to solve those problems. So you could do it as an entrepreneur, as a business person. You could become part of or even start a nonprofit that addresses some of those problems, health, incarceration, gun safety. There's lots of nonprofit opportunities. So I think that, I mean, people have to make money. They have to make a living. But I think starting to think about where I could fit in to actually make a difference, and how can I make a living while I'm making a difference, I think is a great way to think about it.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
That's a lot of material. I know you're going to have to whittle it down.